Hey, vegan freaks, it's Friday, November 3rd, and this is our interview with Gary Francione.
Hey, freaks, how you doing? I'm Bob.
And Jenna.
And we're back again for another episode of Vegan Freak Radio, another in our interview series. Last week we had Lee Hall. Well, last time we did a show, we had Lee Hall on the show. And this week we are very, very pleased to have Gary Francione on the show. Gary Francione is a professor of law at Rutgers. We'll do a proper introduction in a moment, but I just wanted to say we are really stoked to have him on.
Definitely. When we talked about so many good things, it's like I can't wait to share the interview with people.
Exactly. We were trying to decide if we were going to let this interview out on a Friday night, or if we thought, well, do you want to wait until the weekend? But we were just like, let's just get it out right away so people can get to it. Not that, you know, you have a life. You're out there doing something on a Friday night, unlike us.
This is true.
But who knows? So anyway, we're very excited about this interview. Professor Francione talks about all variety of things that are related to animal liberation and to the movement. He talks about the issues around welfareism and abolitionism, and he talks about some of his books, like Rain Without Thunder, and he talks about Introduction to Animal Rights and things like that.
Yeah, and gives, towards the end, arguments as to why we should all be vegan and why we should help other people become vegan, and I think they're very powerful.
Absolutely. So this is one of those interviews that I very much enjoyed doing. I enjoy doing all of them, but this is an interview that we've been trying to schedule for a long time, and I was really pleased to finally gotten the chance to do it, because I know it's the kind of thing that a lot of you are going to appreciate, because I find his logic incredibly compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I find it extremely well-argued, extremely thoughtful, and extremely forward-looking. And part of what he talks about on the show today is something that I personally have been harping on for a very long time. And it's the idea that the vegan movement, if it's going to be a movement of animal liberation, needs to be a movement about oppression of all animals, including humans. Mm-hmm. Can't just be about animals. It's got to be a movement that pulls together all forms of oppression and deals with them. And we talk about that during the show, and I found that to be very powerful.
Indeed.
And it's actually the topic about which I am writing a book.
Yay.
So I found it even more exciting. So yeah, it was great to have Gary on the show. And I think rather than just us mumbling on about it, we should let the interview go. So here it is. And it's about an hour and 5 minutes long. So sit back, enjoy. And if you have comments, podcast@veganfreak.com, because I know some of you will be a little perturbed by some of the things Gary has to say. So hang in there, and here it is. Well, we're here with Gary L. Francione, and Gary Francione is a professor of law in the Nicholas D. Katzenbach Distinguished Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law in Newark, New Jersey. Professor Francione has been teaching animal rights and law for more than 20 years, and he was the first academic to teach animal rights theory in an American law school. He has lectured on the topic throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe, including serving as a member of the guest faculty of the Universidad Complutense de Madrid, and has been a guest on numerous radio and television shows. He is well known throughout the animal protection movement for his criticism of animal welfare law and the property status of non-human animals, and for his abolitionist theory of animal rights. Professor Francione is the author of numerous books and articles on animal rights theory and animals in the law, including Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, Animals, Property, and the Law, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, and Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide to Conscientious Objection. His forthcoming book, Animal Rights, Animal Welfare, and the Law, will be published by Columbia University Press in 2007, and it is our immense pleasure to have Professor Francione on the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited. We've been very excited to talk to you, and we've had a lot of requests to interview you for quite a while now, so pretty interested to get into the interview. So I think is a good place for us to start would be maybe to get you to talk about what animal rights would entail in your view and how your approach to rights is abolitionist.
Well, abolitionism is extremely important to my theory. Indeed, that's really how I think about animal rights. I think that part of the reason that the discourse about animal rights is so confused is because the notion of rights means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So when we start talking about animal rights, people then start thinking, well, what rights do animals have? And we're so used to sort of thinking about the human interests that are protected with rights, that it becomes very, very difficult to think about what animal, what rights means when we apply that concept to animals. And then you also have confusion, given that a lot of people who are welfarists use the expression animal rights quite frequently. So there's a lot of confusion about what animal rights means. And in order, I think, to focus and clarify the issue a little bit, I view the debate as the debate between abolition and regulation. That's how I see it. I see the rights position as the abolitionist position and the welfare position as the position which advocates regulation of animal exploitation in order to make it more humane or whatever. And so that's how I see the debate. I see the debate as the debate between abolition and regulation. When I talk about rights in that context, I talk about only one right, the right not to be treated as property. That, for me, is the only right that's really relevant. And indeed, you can dispense even with talking about the right not to be treated as property if you focus on the moral obligation that humans have not to treat animals as property. That's really what I'm talking about, is not treating animals as property. And once we recognize that obligation, once we recognize that we have a moral obligation not to treat animals as property, or put it in another way, that they have a right not to be treated as property, then we are committed to abolishing, not regulating, but abolishing the exploitations the institutionalized exploitation that assumes that it's all right for us to treat animals as property. I mean, the reason why we do what we do is because they are property. They are things we own. We can do those things to them because they are things. They are not persons. They are things. And once we recognize that we have an obligation not to treat them as things, once we recognize that they have a right not to be treated as things, the institutionalized exploitation that assume the various forms of institutionalized exploitation that assume that they are nothing but things must be abolished. So that's how I see the debate. I see the debate as the debate between abolition and regulation, and therefore when I talk about rights, I'm talking about one right, the right not to be treated as property, or to put the matter in other terms, recognizing that we have a fundamental moral obligation to stop treating sentient creatures as things.
Excellent. I'm wondering how you, in Ring Without Thunder, you kind of tie this into the political economic structure of the animal rights movement and the mainstream organizations throughout the movement. And I'm wondering how you see all this stuff kind of fitting together, the whole emphasis on welfareism and things like that.
Well, the organized movement in this country, and I think this is to some degree true of the movement in other countries, although less so, I think, takes the position that, or at least many segments of it, many of the organizations take the position that they're in favor of abolition, but not yet. That is, we have to continue supporting welfare. And they give two reasons for this. First of all, they say that abolition is, the abolitionist theory is utopian and idealistic and doesn't provide any guidance for us right now to help animals right now. So if we want to help animals right now, we have no choice but to pursue welfare regulation. So that's one aspect of the new welfarist position. The other primary tenet of the new welfarist position is that regulation will lead to abolition. That if we better regulate animal exploitation, that will down the road lead to abolition. What I wrote in Rain Without Thunder, and what I still believe now, indeed, I believe it probably even more fervently than I believed it then in 1996, is that both aspects of that are just wrong. That the abolitionist theory does provide us with normative guidance for what we can do now to alleviate the suffering of animals now, given that nothing that any of us does will alleviate all of the suffering immediately. We all have to accept some theory of incremental change, and the abolitionist position, I believe, does give us things that we can do in the short term to reduce animal suffering. But I also believe that it is folly to suggest that regulation will lead to abolition. If there's one thing history has taught us, welfare leads to more welfare leads to more welfare leads to more welfare. It doesn't lead to abolition. We've had animal welfare for 200 years now, and we have not really succeeded in abolishing any of the forms of institutionalized exploitation. What animal welfare tends to do is to make people more comfortable with animal exploitation, and I think there is historical evidence of that, and there's plenty of it, that animal welfare, regulating exploitation, makes people feel more comfortable with exploitation, and that's common sense. I mean, that shouldn't surprise anybody. I think that part of the problem is that you have many organizations, many animal organizations. They're all competing for the same dollars, and so there's intense competition with these various groups, and they have to have a steady stream of campaigns so that they can win what appear to be victory, so that they can go to you and say, what a great job we're doing, give us more money so we can continue to fight the good fight and win these victories. But in reality, if you look at the things that they're claiming as victories, it's pretty sad. I wouldn't characterize most of these things as victories. Indeed, I would characterize most of them as serious defeats. But if you look at the literature that you get, the promotional literature, for example, several years ago, California enacted a supposed prohibition on foie gras, and what is very interesting is that if you look at the fundraising information that went out after that supposed prohibition was enacted, none of the promotional material I saw, none of the literature I saw, bothered to mention that the prohibition doesn't take effect for another 6 or 7 or 8 years. I don't remember exactly, but it doesn't take effect until sometime well into the future. And the legislation was explicitly rested on the notion that if in the meantime the producers of this product could figure out a more humane way to produce the product, the law would never come into effect. And that, that this period of time was being given by the legislature in order to allow for the development of more humane methods of producing goose liver products. So, this is the sort of thing where I don't view that law as a victory for the movement. I view it as a victory for the foie gras industry. I view it as a victory for animal exploiters. I do not view it as a victory for the animals or for the animal movement, yet it was portrayed as a victory. A lot of fundraising went on based on it. And the literature I saw about it, none of the groups that I saw bothered to mention that this was something that had a 6 or 7 or 8 year, again, I don't recall exactly how long it was, delay. Didn't bother to mention that the legislation was expressly based on the notion that this period, this delay, was for the development of a, quote, more humane method of producing the product. And that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. These groups need victories so that they can come to you and say, Bob, Jenna, give us money. and they need a steady stream of these things. And when you've got as many groups as there are in this country, you're talking about fairly intense competition. So they're looking around for campaigns they can win.
Actually, I've talked to the HSUS about their battery egg campaign. Well, I've talked to one person there about the battery egg campaign, and one of his, I don't want to mischaracterize what he said, so I'll just say, forget about the HSUS. Other people I've talked to about this have said, well, by enacting all these kinds of welfareist reforms, by putting things into law, by adding all of these different humane methods, it makes the cost of producing animal products more expensive. And so the idea is that as it gets more and more expensive, as these restrictions become more and more onerous on the industry, we will eventually, at some mythical point in the future, see an eventual decline in the consumption of animal products. I'm wondering how you would respond to that kind of critique of your thoughts on this.
Well, that's certainly a position that a lot of people take, and there are also people who believe that, every December 25th, a large weight-challenged man comes down their chimney in their stockings. That's fantasy. I mean, first of all, let's look at let's look at some of these campaigns. You mentioned the HSUS. Which campaign were you talking about?
The battery. Well, they had a campaign where they were trying to get battery cage-free eggs into school cafeterias.
Yeah. I've just finished writing an article in which I talk about two of the HSUS campaigns. One is the gassing of the chickens, and the other is the gestation crate campaign with respect to pigs. If you look at the HSUS literature, both of those campaigns are based on the notion that if animal exploiters adopt these supposedly more humane methods, it will actually be economically beneficial for them. We're not talking about adding a great deal of cost. And in some cases, particularly with the gestation crate, if I recall the HSUS literature, they made the point of saying that producers would probably actually do better, because the European studies indicated that alternatives to the gestation crate produced healthier animals and were more, and that the alternatives were more profitable for exploiters. As I recall, the literature on the gassing of the chickens, they mentioned that equipment required a one-time capital outlay that was fairly expensive, but that afterward the cost of injured birds would go down. You know, the economic losses suffered as a result of injured birds would go down, and it would be safer for the workers. So they'd have fewer worker injuries and less carcass damage, and this would inure to the benefit of the producers. And I think, you know, first of all, I think that most of these measures don't do anything but require animal exploiters to behave as rational property owners. I mean, really what the animal people are saying to the exploiters is, look, you're not being as efficient as you could be. You could protect animal interests more and make more money at the same time. But that's not changing the property status of animals. All you're doing is saying to the exploiter, you're not being a rational property owner. If you think about it, you could actually do better if you adopt this method or that improvement. You can actually make more profit. So that's not really changing the property status of animals. As far as making demand go down, none of the things which are being proposed are going to, I mean, none of these things will result in dramatically higher prices for animal products. We're talking relatively small amounts of money. And in the end, it's not going to really make much difference. I mean, then there's an additional thing that I don't see discussed, and that is the problem of free trade, and I'm not an expert in free trade, but these free trade agreements basically prohibit discriminating against imports on moral grounds. So to the extent that the demand remains for the cheaper product, I think it is, again, I'm not an expert in international trade, but people who are experts in international trade tell me that it's certainly a serious question as to whether or not the products which are made not in accordance with the supposedly more humane practices have to be allowed in, and so therefore, to the extent that the demand is there, those products will still be available. I know that that's the experience, or at least as I've read, that is the experience in Europe, that that although some welfare standards are different, that some countries have higher welfare standards, that basically products that are manufactured in accordance with the lower welfare standards have to be admitted into the market because you're not permitted under these free trade agreements to discriminate on moral grounds.
That's actually, I think that's true. I'm pretty sure if that were to happen, that kind of discrimination, the offended party could take a case to the WTO about the whole problem.
I believe that's true. You know, I believe that's true. But you see, that basically undercuts that whole argument because to the extent that what you're saying is these welfare measures will increase the cost of animal products and therefore decrease demand. If the demand is still there, the products will come into the market if there's no barrier to their coming in. And indeed, as I understand it, these free trade agreements prohibit the imposition of these barriers. Mm-hmm. So if that is in fact the case, and I believe it is, and you believe it is, so we have unanimity of agreement on this show for this moment, then that whole argument doesn't work. But I don't even think you have to get into that, because I think if you look at what these organizations are proposing, they're not proposing things which are going to dramatically affect demand because price is going to go, you know, it's going to be increased dramatically. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that comes out of all this discussion of welfare, I think, is going back to what you said at the beginning of the interview, is that welfareism still sees animals as something for us to use and own, and because of that, you know, you can't get past you can't get past the exploitation of the animals. So.
You know, look, animals are property. Now, let's think about what that means for a second, because animals are property. They are things. They are economic commodities that have only extrinsic or conditional value. They are only things that have value to us. They have the value that we give them. They don't have inherent value. They only have, you know, they don't have intrinsic value. They only have extrinsic or conditional value. Okay? Now, animal property is different from other sorts of property because animal property, animals have interests, unlike your television or your computer or your telephone or whatever the other things are that you own. Animals have minds, they feel pain, they have emotions, they have awareness. They are property that has interests. That's the only, and since we don't have human slavery anymore, or at least it's not legal, non-humans are the only form of property that we have that has that characteristic of having interests. Now, because animals are property and because they have interests, respecting their interests costs money. Every time you respect an animal interest, it costs money. And that is why animal welfare is generally limited to protecting the interests that we have to protect in order to exploit the animal. That's the theory that I proposed in Animals, Property, and Law in 1995, and I've just made it for about 353 pages shorter for you. but that's really the thesis. The thesis of that book is that animals have interests, but protecting those interests costs money, and as a result, because they're property and because they don't have any inherent or intrinsic value, because they only have extrinsic or conditional value, the only interest that we're going to protect, they have lots of interests. Which are the ones we're going to protect? We're going to protect the ones we need to protect in order to exploit those animals in an economically efficient way. So, for example, if you look at the Humane Slaughter Act, that's a good example. Look at the Humane Slaughter Act, where it's not prohibiting the imposition of all suffering at the slaughterhouse. No, by no means. And if you don't believe me, go to visit your local slaughterhouse. They're horrible places. The Humane Slaughter Act is not prohibiting all pain and suffering in the slaughtering process, but only the pain and suffering that we can stop, where we get a benefit from stopping that pain and suffering. So we require animals to be stunned before they're shackled and hoisted, because if they're not stunned before they're shackled and hoisted, there's more carcass damage and workers get injured more, because, you know, you're talking about large animals. If the animals are jumping around on the chain there that they're hoisted up on, if they're conscious, they're going to be moving. If they're moving, a 2,000 pound animal hits somebody, they're going to injure that person. You're going to have worker injuries. So if you look at the Humane Slaughter Act, The interests of the animals that are protected are those that we need to protect in order to prevent carcass damage and worker injuries. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to find examples of animal welfare where interests of animals are protected beyond what is required in order to efficiently exploit the animal. And what is distressing and sad to me is it's 2006, and we're not getting any further at all with this, because if you look at the campaigns that are being proposed by PETA, by HSUS, by these other groups, it's basically this. It fits within the same paradigm. Look, for example, at victory was declared by Peter Singer and by PETA with respect to McDonald's adoption of slaughtering methods that were proposed by Temple Grandin. And, you know, these were eventually, I think, also picked up by Wendy's and Burger King. So these fast food places are now supposedly only purchasing from suppliers who employ Temple Grandin's happy slaughter methods, or whatever she calls them. And if you look at what Temple Grandin says, if you go and you read what Temple Grandin, you read Temple Grandin's guidelines, they are all based on the notion that if you do certain sorts of things to calm the animals down on the way as they're going down the ramp. If you do things to calm them down, there will be fewer injuries to the animals. The carcass will be of a higher quality. You'll be able to get more money for it, and there'll be fewer worker injuries. It's based on the same sorts of considerations that motivated the passage of the Humane Slaughter Act in 1958. So you know, it's this is where we are, 2006. And this is a natural consequence of the property status of animals. Because they are economic commodities, it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend more money than to protect more interests than you have to in order to exploit the animals. Because the more interests you protect, the higher the price of the product is. And you know, laws of supply and demand are such that suppliers aren't, you know, exploiters aren't going to do that. And the public, you know, the public may have vague sympathies for animals, but the bottom line is most people are simply not willing to pay a lot more for their animal products. They might pay, you know, a couple cents more. Some people might pay a couple cents more, but most people aren't willing to do that.
Unless they're shopping at Whole Foods, right?
Yes, exactly. Unless they're shopping at Whole Foods and they're purchasing the corpses of animals that were so happy to die, they went and they fell on their swords in order to serve the interests of John Mackey. But that's really just appalling, that whole situation. Anyway.
Yeah, I bring up Whole Foods purposely because Peter Singer has been speaking out very loudly lately in favor of Whole Foods and what he's called their pioneering initiatives, you know, taken by Whole Foods. And there was this big letter that was signed by, maybe you saw it in Satya Magazine, I think it was in September, signed by a variety of animal rights organizations and things like that. You've kind of spoken pretty broadly about these things, but when I look at that, I feel like it's the movement kind of being co-opted or taken over by the interests of animal exploiters. We're getting on the side of animal exploiters, and I'm not sure
who the animal exploiters are. I mean, I see Peter Singer as an animal exploiter. I mean, I don't see Peter Singer as an animal advocate. I see him as an animal exploiter. I mean, I think Peter Singer, to me, it's shocking, the positions that man takes. They're just shocking. Now, I think he intends them to be shocking, and I think that's a big part of who he is. I see him as an animal exploiter. I mean, he's busy. What's troubling to me is Peter Singer is promoting the idea that we can be morally conscientious omnivores. Now, that is a very troubling position to be taking in a movement. Let me give you an explanation for that. I understand the idea that if you're going to inflict harm, it's always better to inflict less harm than more harm. So if Joe decides he is going to rape Mary, I understand the idea that it would be better if Joe also didn't beat her as well as rape her. I understand that. But I would find it disconcerting if a human rights movement or human rights organization took the position that we could be conscientious, morally conscientious rapists if we didn't beat rape victims in addition to rape them. You know, similarly, you know, you can play out the example in a million different contexts. You know, yes, you know, if you're going to molest a child, it's better to molest a child 5 times rather than 10 times. But for somebody to take the position that you could be a morally conscientious child molester, if you limit yourself to, you know, 4 instances or 5 instances of child molestation, I would find that morally repugnant. So I understand if somebody says, you know, if you're going to eat meat, you shouldn't eat meat. You shouldn't eat it. You shouldn't eat any meat, any dairy. You should be a vegan. If you're going to eat something, it's always better to eat something which involves less harm rather than more harm. I understand it. That's a common sense, understandable notion. But to then take the position that you can be a morally conscientious person in doing that then takes a step that is deeply problematic, because now you have Peter Singer, the so-called father of the animal rights movement, taking the position that we can be morally conscientious omnivores. Well, let me tell you, you don't need an IQ above 10 to figure out that if you tell people who are concerned about these issues that they can be morally conscientious people and not be vegans, you know what? They ain't going to be vegans.
Good point.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, he argues that point very, Singer Mason argued that point extensively in their latest book, The Way We Eat. I always get the title mixed up, but they argue that point extensively. I mean, they even talk about how the, you know, kind of moral, the overwhelming morality of veganism is damaging. And I read that and I found that really problematic.
Well, look, as I say, I think Peter Singer is part of the problem. He's not part of the solution. I mean, he promotes animal exploitation. I mean, that's an empirically true statement. He promotes animal exploitation. And he tells people that they can engage in exploitation and be morally sound people. Well, I'm sorry, I disagree with that. I think that that's problematic. And I think a movement that is unclear about where he fits in it, and that he's not on our side, he's on their side, I think is a confused movement. I mean, there's a lot in that book. I agree that that's a deeply disturbing book on multiple levels. And you know, there's the portion where he and Mason go to a turkey farm and work inseminating turkeys for a day, and you know, and they tell us how horrible it is and how brutal it is to the birds, but here they are busy removing the semen from the male turkeys and injecting it into the female turkeys, and they're telling us about this. Now, I find it, first of all, I think that conduct is violent. I think it clearly exploits the animals, and there's Singer and Mason engaging in that conduct, and from what I have seen, the movement hasn't been particularly perturbed by it.
So I guess the next question I would have is where the movement has been going, and it's been going this way, it seems like, for decades now.
Yeah.
Where should we be going? I mean, I know where we're not going, but where should we be going?
Well, look, I think it's important to recognize there really isn't. I mean, we call it a movement. I call it a movement. We all, you know, we all use that expression, but it's not really a movement. There are people out there who claim to be concerned about animals, but there's no political movement. They're not doing anything about it. The legislative initiatives, the legal thing, you know, the various campaigns that are going on are not doing anything other than further embedding animals in the property paradigm. I think, you know, again, you know, if the revolution is Singer's promoting, you know, Whole Foods and John Mackey, then it's a pretty sad revolution. I think it's important for people who are concerned about this to forget about those people. is basically, I think one of, you know, I frequently I get a lot of emails from people who are critical of things that PETA does, and they want to know, you know, well, what can we do? How can we stop PETA from doing it? And I always say, just forget about PETA. Forget about PETA. Forget about PETA, forget about HSUS, forget about Peter Singer, forget about all of them. And we need to start working outside of, you know, the movement or whatever else it is you want to call it, the phenomenon. Just working outside of it and ignoring it, because we've really got nothing in common. Those of us who want to do abolition, who are interested in abolitionism, really have nothing in common with those people. That we have absolutely nothing in common with them. And they're doing something very, very different, you know. And so it really is, I guess it's the difference, you know, if you see yourself as opposed to rape, you wouldn't see yourself as part of the movement that says, let's make sure all rape is humane. You know, I mean, you know, let's make sure that when, you know, when people, you know, when men rape women, they don't beat them too severely. If you're opposed to rape, that's not the position that would appeal to you. And you wouldn't see yourself, you wouldn't see yourself as part of that movement. Indeed, you would see yourself in many ways as outside of it. And I think that's what we need to do here. We need to take a step back and say, just as the ideas of humane rape or humane pedophilia or, you know, whatever other thing you want to put in there, we need to see, just as we don't see those things as characterizing our concerns about violence to women or violence to children or whatever, we have to recognize that the whole campaign or the whole way of looking at things that has us being conscientious omnivores really has nothing to do with abolition or the sorts of things that abolitionists are concerned about. And 10 years ago, stepping outside and sort of saying, let's just ignore them, was difficult to do. But it's not, it's much less difficult now because of the internet, which reduces the opportunity costs of communication tremendously and allows people to communicate with each other in ways that they couldn't in the past, and allows for organization to develop outside of the formal organizations that exist. And I think we just need to take advantage of that. As a matter of fact, I'm busy working on a new website now, which is focusing on abolitionism and veganism, which I see as being basically the veganism as being the application of the principle of abolition to the life of the individual. We can talk about that in a couple of minutes, but in which I'm focusing on abolition and veganism, that will get out there, and that will stimulate debate. And, you know, I will always end up getting nasty emails from the welfarists, what I call the pedophiles, the PETA people who will be critical. I don't care. I mean, I really don't care. Several weeks ago, when I first read the Way We Eat, and I read that section about Singer and Mason going to the turkey farm, I was shocked. I was really shocked. And I wrote something that I put out that I gave to somebody who put it on AR News or one of these groups. And I got, I got a lot of positive feedback, but I got, I got the predictable group of people who told me that it was absolutely wrong to criticize Peter Singer, and that, we should never do those sorts of things, and it doesn't matter what he does, we should never criticize publicly and things like that. And I just ignored it. That's what God gave us delete buttons for. and I just delete that stuff because I recognize that there are a lot of people who look at this in a very culty sort of way. And, there's no intellectual discussion or debate permitted. You just have to do what you're told. It's very, very cultish. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that I'm going to get negative feedback from those people, but I ignore them and I go on with things. And so I think that's what we need to do. I mean, I think we need to develop, a movement outside of the movement. And I mean a real movement. I mean, a movement that's coherent. A movement that is progressive politically, that is part of a progressive political movement, and where the people who are involved share some common moral and political values, and come from a progressive political background. And I don't think they're out there. I know they're out there. And what's wonderful is we can now communicate with each other, which we couldn't have done not without a very, very high cost. But now we can find each other. There are places in cyberspace that we can go to meet each other, to talk, to discuss things. And things have evolved to such a point where if I wanted, I could spend all day communicating with people on the internet about these sorts of things from different countries. I could do this all day, every day.
Absolutely.
And now that I have tenure, I'm inclined to do that. No. But I mean, there are possibilities. We have to take advantage of those possibilities. We have to be creative about those things. We have to take advantage of those possibilities. The abolitionist message is getting out in various places where it couldn't have gotten out in years gone by. And because of the internet, people are interested, and people are communicating with each other. Just amazing. I had an essay, fairly radical essay in Le Monde Diplomatique, I guess it was in August. And I have gotten probably 250 responses from people all over the world, because Le Monde Diplomatique is a fairly prestigious progressive publication. A lot of European people who are on the left and well-read on the left people read Le Monde Diplomatique. And I have gotten an enormously positive response from that essay, which talks about the abolition of animal slavery. I mean, that's That's roughly what the title is. So, you know, I didn't write it in French. It was translated, but I feel so intellectual now because everybody thinks I write in French. But it was translated by somebody. So I think that, you know, and I'm going to be doing another essay for Le Monde Diplomatique. And, you know, I was in Spain in May, giving lectures at the University of Valencia, the University of Murcia, and, Carlos Trace University in Madrid. And, I mean, again, the reaction, and I wasn't talking about regulation, I wasn't talking about making larger, you know, battery cages McDonald's new happy slaughter methods or whatever. I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about why are we eating animals at all? Why aren't we vegans? I mean, isn't that the morally rational thing for us to be doing if we say we're civilized? And it was remarkable the reaction I was getting. And as a result of that experience I had in Spain, I've now got, you know, a number of students in various Spanish universities that are corresponding with me regularly and are thinking of doing their dissertations on abolitionist theory and things like that. So that's what we really need to be doing. And you know, it's important to, you know, to some degree, the problem is our fault, because what we've done is we've allowed people like Singer and Newkirk and these other people to sort of take it over. And then we sit around, you know, and worry about what they're saying and, you know, react to what they're saying. At some point in time, you have to walk away from it and say, it's wrong. Here's why it's wrong. I'll never stop criticizing it. But I think you also have to go on to be constructive in terms of, all right, what are we going to do? What are we going to do as an alternative? And what we need to do is to build an abolitionist movement. And we're not going to get any help from them, I can tell you. We're not going to get any help from them.
I absolutely agree. One of the things you said that really strikes a chord with me is this, how we need a kind of common moral and political values to drive the movement, a progressive movement. And one of the things that I always talk about is how I think the movement itself has to focus on oppression on the whole, oppression of animals,
absolutely,
oppression of people, all of that together. And I always get frustrated because some people want to fetishize animal oppression. And I understand that animal oppression is in fact horrible. And I've devoted a significant proportion of my life in the last couple of years to talking about that. But I think we need to look at all of oppression overall to really deal with this.
But, you know, and look, Bob, the reason why that's not only desirable, but essential, is to think about it for a second. You're not going to get people to extend their moral sympathy, if they don't have moral sympathies that go to members of their own species, they're not going to have moral sympathies that go to members of other species.
Absolutely.
Indeed, if you have people who have moral sympathies, not for members of their own species, but for members of other species, we call them misanthropes. And I think that, you know, for example, you know, I remember, I don't really speak at animal rights conferences anymore because life is too short, but one of the things I used to hear at animal rights conferences all the time was that, well, you know, I love animals, but I hate people. And I used to hear, as a matter of fact, if I had a nickel for every time I heard somebody say that, or the other thing I used to hear all the time was, why don't we use prisoners in experiments? I mean, isn't it better for us to use prisoners? We shouldn't use animals. Why aren't we using prisoners?
Wow.
And I used to hear that all the time. And whenever I used to hear that, as tiresome as it was, I used to always address the person who said it and say, look, we need to focus on that for a second, because that doesn't make any sense. You know, what you're promoting, I mean, you're saying that, well, I'm opposed to violence against animals, but I'm in favor of violence to humans. Or I would, you know, hear, I don't care about humans, or you know, I'm not worried about exploitation of humans. I mean, I remember, you know, when I first got involved with this movement, I'm in addition to being a law professor, I'm also a lawyer, and I've worked with, over the years, I worked with almost all of the large organizations, and indeed was involved closely with a number of them in the 80s and early 90s. By the mid 90s, later 90s, I stopped doing that. But I know a lot of these folks personally, and you know, I've had a lot of discussions with them about, for example, I was an early objector to the "I'd rather go naked than wear fur" campaign, because it seemed to me quite clear that as long as we were treating women as pieces of meat, we would most likely treat meat as pieces of meat, and eroticizing the fur issue was not a good idea. And yet, what I found when I try to raise that in the movement was, we don't really care, even if it perpetuates sexism. What difference does it make? It's for the animals. You know, the sanctimonious, we do it for the animals. And the bottom line is, I mean, first of all, it hasn't worked. I mean, the whole fur campaign has been an enormous failure. Fur is a bigger, more powerful, and more lucrative industry than it's ever been in the history of its existence. But, you know, what we also ended up doing with that campaign was alienating a lot of women who found it really offensive, quite properly. You know, quite properly. And you know, and I think a lot of these campaigns are really reactionary. They're horribly reactionary. And I think that we have got to recognize at some point that if we're going to get people to, you know, you're not going to get people who don't care about the, you know, the exploitation of humans. You're not going to get those people to be particularly concerned about animals. Think about it. If you've got somebody who doesn't care about human slavery, are they likely to care about non-human slavery? And I would be deeply concerned and would not want to be anywhere near somebody who says, I don't care about human slavery, but I do care about animal slavery. I would find such a person to be a person I would not want to be alone in a room with. So, and I think there are a lot of those folks out there in the animal movement who don't have any particular warm feelings or moral feelings for members of their own species, and I think that's problematic. And I think that if the movement is going to succeed, if the movement's ever going to make any progress, it's only going to do so once it locates itself in a progressive political context and recognize where it's coming from and what it's part of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I guess to sort of round out our interview here, we have a lot of listeners who are on their way to vegan but not quite there yet, and we've heard you in the past give your explanation, very logical explanation of why we should be vegan, and it basically all comes down to taste. We were wondering if you could just maybe explain that for our listeners?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. I don't understand.
Well, I think in one of your books, you give an example of how you kind of talk your students through veganism in the first couple of days. You know, you kind of convince them right on the spot that they should be vegan if they care about suffering.
Oh, okay. I mean, what I do basically is, for example, I mean, I'll be giving a lecture. I did this actually in Spain, and it worked remarkably well. I will ask people, how many people have dogs or cats in their household? You know, almost everybody raises a hand, and I say, well, you know, do you recognize that your dog or your cat is a sentient being? You know, oh yes. Do you recognize that your dog and your cat they have emotions, they have feelings, they have, you know, they feel pain, they experience pleasure, they really have very complex cognitive characteristics? Oh yes, absolutely. Now imagine you were to be walking down the street and you were to encounter someone who was about to blowtorch a dog. And you stop the person and say, why are you doing this? And the person says, well, because I enjoy it. would you have a problem with that? And, you know, or how many people in the audience would not have a problem with that? Nobody ever, you know, I mean, everybody always agrees, yes, that would be horrible. That would be more morally monstrous. I get people raising their hands saying, those are the people we should put in jail, et cetera, et cetera. And then after I get everybody to recognize that their dogs and their cats are creatures that have complex cognitive characteristics, and that blowtorching one of them for reasons of pleasure or amusement would be a monstrous thing to do, then I ask, how many people here eat meat or dairy? And then you also have everybody then putting their hands up, you see. And then I say, okay, now tell me how what you're doing is any different from the kid who's about to blowtorch the dog. I mean, first of all, the animals that you're eating are no different cognitively from the animals that you have in your house that are members of your family that you love, that you recognize are truly non-human persons. They have personalities, they have minds, they experience pain, they experience pleasure, they have awareness, they're self-conscious, etc. And, you know, you recognize that. Tell me how what you're doing is any different. And then we go through it and we recognize that, well, there is no justification for eating animal products other than pleasure, amusement, or convenience. In a sense, we are no different from the kid who's blowtorching the dog. The only difference is most of us pay somebody to go and torture the animal. But we have no better justification for eating animal products than does the kid who's blowtorching the dog, and whose only justification is, I do it because I enjoy blowtorching the dog. I enjoy inflicting pain and suffering. I get something out of this. I get some pleasure, some amusement out of this. We're no different from that kid. Absolutely none. Not as a moral matter, there is absolutely no difference. And then I get them to focus on the fact, you know, then I always get the question, but what's wrong with dairy? They don't kill the animals for dairy. And the answer is, they sure as heck do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, dairy animals are kept alive longer than their meat counterparts. They're treated worse, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse. We end up eating them anyway. They just live longer, worse lives. They suffer more, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse. And frankly, if you're concerned about animal suffering, and someone tells you you've got to either eat the steak or drink the glass of milk, and you're going to make the decision based only on suffering, you probably ought to eat the steak, because there's probably more suffering in a glass of milk than there is in the pound of steak. But you shouldn't be eating any of it. Absolutely. And if you take animal, and I think that one of the most serious problems with the organized animal business, I guess that's a better, that's actually a much better description of the movement. The organized animal business doesn't embrace veganism as a moral baseline. Indeed, the moral baseline is being a conscientious omnivore. So we should all be eating free range. That's the sort of the default position. The default position ought to be none of us should be eating any of it. There is no reason for it whatsoever. It is immoral to do. It is no different from the kid who's blowtorching the dog. There's no need for it whatsoever. Nobody, I mean, it's 2006, nobody maintains you need to eat meat for health reasons. Indeed, most people, including mainstream people, I mean, the more you read, the more you recognize that even mainstream healthcare people are recognizing that animal products are deadly, and it's in animal products and animal agriculture is an environmental disaster. So there is no reason for it whatsoever. and I think it's imperative that we recognize that if you take animal interests seriously, you don't have a choice in this matter. You've got to be vegan. I mean, if you're an abolitionist, it makes no more sense to continue eating animal products than saying I'm an abolitionist with respect to slavery, but I still own a few. You know, it's the same sort of thing. And I frequently I have people say to me, oh, I'm totally with you. I agree with your abolitionist theory. And then I say, are you a vegan? They say no. And I say, well, let's talk about that, because you've got a problem here, and you need to get some consistency in your life, because if you in fact are an abolitionist, then you need to understand that veganism is nothing more than applying the principle of abolition to your own life. And you know what? Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're not going to end animal exploitation, you know, by tomorrow. It's not going to happen. But the one thing that every single one of us can do right now, right at this very moment, is to stop consuming them, to stop eating them, to stop eating meat, to stop eating dairy, to stop wearing them, to stop using products that have been tested on them. Those are things that we can do right now, right now. So it's you know, we can do something immediately. You want to do something to stop animal suffering now, stop eating them. And, you know, for every person who stops eating them, demand goes down, you know, by, I don't know, what, 35, 40 animals a year, whatever. But, I mean, you know, everybody who embraces a vegan lifestyle is saving at least, I mean, I, you know, at least 35, 40, probably more if you count fish and stuff in that. You know, you're talking probably in excess of, you know, 40 animals a year. So if you want to do something for animals now, go vegan. And that's an argument I've been making that I made to the organized animal business going back as far as 1985. When we were sitting around strategizing about what to do, my position always was, let's put all of our money and our resources, all of our labor, all of our money, into a vegan campaign. And people said, yeah, but, you know, wouldn't it be better if we got bigger cages for the birds? Wouldn't that be better in terms of alleviating suffering? And the answer is no, because we're not gonna end all suffering immediately anyway. All we can do is to take incremental steps in the short term. And if we would have a sustained vegan campaign now, in another 20 years, we will have decreased suffering dramatically through decreasing demand and building a base for a meaningful political and social movement that would support more dramatic changes as time went on. Right now, we have a movement that, you know, of people who say, I'm in favor of humane animal treatment. Well, you know what? I'm 52 years old. I've never met anybody in my life who disagrees with that, including people who exploit animals.
Absolutely. So I like that a lot, actually, because I always feel like what we're doing in the movement or the business or whatever you want to call it, we end up going after the wrong ends, I think. I don't see enough promotion of veganism. And I guess one of the things, you know, you advise kind of routing around the mainstream movement. How would you advise that the average person just get started doing that stuff? Because a lot of people feel really overwhelmed. Some people feel really helpless about it. But do you have any advice? I mean, apart from just going vegan, how people can start?
But you can't dismiss that as an insignificant thing, because I meet a lot of people, Bob, who express that frustration to me, and they say, you know, I'm just, what do I do? What's the first thing I do? And then I say to them, are you vegan? And they say, well, no. And then I end up having a discussion because they've read something that Peter Singer wrote or something that, you know, the PETA people put out, and they say, well, you know, do I really have to be a vegan? And the answer is, yeah, you do. And you say, you've got to get past that. But I really think that it's imperative, you know, that we not in any way sort of dismiss the importance of that initial step to go vegan. And then the thing to do, I think, for most people who have limited time, and, you know, they don't have, you know, they don't necessarily have all the time in the world to do various things, but by going vegan and then trying to educate everybody around you about veganism can have a tremendous impact. I got an email 2 days ago from somebody in Spain, actually, who came to my lectures at Valencia. She has become a vegan now, and that's all she will talk about with anybody, basically. I mean, she's really, really, the vegan bug bit her hard. And and she's now talking about veganism with everybody and all the people in her workplace. And she went on a business trip, and she was talking to, you know, everybody wanted to know why she wasn't eating the food that everybody else was eating. And she was explaining about veganism. And she had, now, there are some people, you know, that I would suspect that a majority of the people in her life are not accepting it, or at least not accepting it immediately. But what she's finding is that some people are very interested and are engaging her on it, and they're starting to change their habits, and she's starting to get feedback from the people she's talking to about veganism. And she's not a public person. She's not on radio shows. She's not on television shows. She's not speaking at conferences. She's a business person. She's a mid-level manager in a company. And, you know, and she's been exposed to these ideas. Now the ideas have turned her on. They make sense to her. She's now promoting them with everybody she comes in contact with. And those people are then educating the people they come in contact with. If she continues doing what she's doing, she will be directly responsible for a number of other people adopting the vegan lifestyle. And then those people will get turned on by the idea, and they'll turn more people on. And that's what's really important. It's a clear, I mean, the nice thing about veganism is it doesn't get you involved in all discussions about how free range does it have to be before, you know, we can be morally conscientious about it. It's a nice, clear, clean line. Nothing. You know, we don't eat nothing. And very, very, and it makes sense. It really, I mean, once you explain it in its theoretical context, it makes absolute sense. One of the things I try to do with Introduction to Animal Rights is present a theory of animal rights that is, you know, that isn't something that you need to have, you know, 50 years of philosophical training to understand. I mean, you know, if an idea is a good idea, it's an idea that should be explainable to anybody. And I think, you know, we can get wrapped up, I think, in a lot of academic elitism, thinking that, well, you know, you need some sort of very complex theory to make this all make sense. You don't. If you take animal suffering seriously, you shouldn't be eating any of them. You don't even need to know anything about rights theory. You don't need to know what a right is. You don't need to know how rights function. I mean, it's nice, but I mean, you don't need to know any of that stuff to understand that if you take seriously the idea that animals are members of the moral community, you can't eat members of the moral community. It's that simple. You just can't. I mean, that's, you don't need 63 years of philosophical training to understand that if X is a member of the moral community, you shouldn't eat X. You shouldn't exploit X and, you know, and keep X constantly pregnant so that you can get milk from her that she's supposed to be giving, you know, to her babies to make them become 2,000-pound animals. I mean, you know, and I think, now, you know, one of the things that happens a lot is once people understand this, they say, yeah, but, you know, isn't your theory really a theory that says we shouldn't have domestic animals at all? And the bottom line is yes. That's exactly right. You've got it. Anybody who asks me that question, I get a feeling of warmth in my heart because I realize they've understood what I'm talking about. You know, if we really took these ideas seriously, we would stop bringing billions of animals into existence every year for the sole purpose of treating them as things. Once they become moral persons, we stop bringing them into existence. You know, and that's the basic problem. The issue is not whether the cow should have legal standing to sue the farmer for acts of cruelty. The question is, why do we have the cow here in the first place?
Excellent.
You know, why are we bringing domestic animals into existence in the first place? And I think we need to, you know, we need to focus on that. And I get asked that question a lot. I get a lot of animal people get very hostile to me when they say, well, are you saying we shouldn't have dogs and cats? And the answer is, I've got five. I had seven. Two passed away last year. I've got five rescued dogs. I love dogs. I enjoy them. You will probably won't find anybody on the planet who loves them more than I do. But if it were up to me, there were two dogs left on the planet, and it were up to me as to whether or not they were going to continue to breed so that we could have dogs. Wonderful but perpetually vulnerable animals that are dependent on us for when they eat, when they drink, when they go to the bathroom, et cetera. The answer is no, absolutely not. We have no business. I mean, we should not have dogs and cats, and we shouldn't, and we certainly shouldn't continue breeding them. We should take care of the ones that we have here now,
absolutely,
but we should not be continuing to breed them.
Couldn't agree.
Now, I probably alienated now by making that comment a lot of people in your audience, but I'm sorry. I don't mean to. I'm just
no. I think a lot of people actually agree with you out there. Because I think people forget exactly how agriculture works. I mean, we forget that the point you just made, that we bring them into existence. They're not just out copulating in the fields. We make turkeys have sex. Singer and Mason know that very well, apparently. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, do you have that book?
Oh, yeah.
Did you, when I got to page, I think it was page 28, you know, at this point in my life, it takes a lot to shock me. And I read pages 28 and 29 of that book, and I was absolutely shocked that they did it. And I don't know what shocked me more, that they did it or that they said in such a nonchalant way that they did it. I don't know what shocked me more. But in any event, the animals that we exploit are not naturally occurring beings. They're not beings. I mean, you know, if we took all the cows that we have now and sort of put them out in the field and said, okay, we're going to leave you alone, they'd all be dead soon. I mean, these are animals that are dependent on us completely. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, domestic animals. They don't. They're animals that we have either through various ways we have selectively bred these animals to have certain characteristics. These are not natural beings. These are very unnatural beings. The pigs that we have now, you know, came ultimately from wild pigs, and there are still, you know, wild ones in various parts of the world. But I mean, the animals, the domestic animals that we have now, are animals that are here because we caused them to come into existence. And if we took their interests seriously, the solution is not to become morally conscientious omnivores. We should just stop eating them altogether, and we should address the problem by hitting the demand, because that's really, in the end, the only way it's going to work, the only way we're going to have any progress is to hit the demand. Because, you know, when we earlier in the interview, Bob, you mentioned the strategy that we're going to decrease demand by increasing price. Well, you know, first of all, in order for that to be meaningful, the increase in prices has to be dramatic, and that's not something the market is going to tolerate anytime soon, like in the next several zillion years. I mean, that's not going to happen. That sort of level of price increase isn't going to happen, number one. Number two, even if it did, I firmly believe that, you know, in the present international legal context, what you'd end up have happening is you have other producers who were not producing the more expensive food coming in to satisfy the demand. So the problem is the demand. And the only way we're ultimately going to deal with this situation is to deal with the demand. And if we deal with the demand, you know, as I say, by every person who becomes a vegan, the demand decreases. If we could get a sizable portion of the population to embrace veganism, that would affect demand. And again, the whole vegan thing, it really does, the vegan approach really does have the advantage of being something that it's an unusual idea, and it's something that people can identify with, because even though it's unusual, it's far more clear than telling people, oh, you ought to treat animals humanely. Everybody understands that. Everybody agrees with it. It doesn't have any practical effect in terms of what people are doing. Whereas veganism is an idea, you know, once you turn somebody onto it, you know, and they grab it, it excites them. It becomes a real defining principle of their lives, and it's something that they can share with other people.
Absolutely. I couldn't think of a better place to close out the interview. Is there anything else that you would like to touch on that we didn't ask about that you want to have out there?
I'm a vegan. I have unbounded amounts of energy. I mean, if you want to keep going for the next several hours, we can do everything. No, anything else that you didn't touch on that you wanted to touch on is...
No, I was very happy to hear you talk about veganism, because I agree with you 100% that it needs to be the baseline of what we do. And a lot of what I do is try to promote veganism, because I think that that's one of the most effective ways to get at any of this.
Let me end with a little story here.
Okay.
I got an invitation to be part of a project. They wanted me to participate with a group of other people. And the name of the project was Heroes of the Vegan Movement. And so they wanted me to participate. And I ultimately declined. And one of the reasons I declined was because I said, I have a problem with the word hero. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with the idea of portraying someone who is doing what we all should be doing as doing something that's extraordinary. And I think that part of the problem is the animal business goes out of its way to portray veganism as the extreme position, mm-hmm. and to portray the default or normal position as the eating, you know, being a morally conscientious omnivore. And that, you know, what the organized animal groups are telling people as well, you don't have to be a vegan. That's an extreme thing. You know, those of us who are vegans, we're heroes. We're special people. You know, you, the unwashed masses, it's okay. You know, you go to Whole Foods and buy your free-range eggs and your happy, you know, your happy corpses or whatever, and that's okay. You know, you can be conscientious omnivores, and that's all right. And you know, being a vegan is an extreme thing. We recognize it's an extreme thing. It's a difficult thing to do. And I object to that. I really object to the idea of portraying veganism as something that is extraordinarily hard to do, or is something that only the heroic spirit can embrace. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. It's elitist. It's foolish. You know, 20-some-odd years ago, when I became a vegan, you know, it was a lot more difficult then in the sense that there wasn't a lot of vegan food around, not stuff that you could get easily. I mean, you know, there were always fruits and vegetables, but if you were wanting to have cooked foods or prepared foods or stuff, there really wasn't a lot of choice around. And when I first became a vegan, you know, the soy, there were, as I recall, some attempts at soy ice cream, and they were things that you wouldn't feed to your worst enemy. They were really horrible. But now it is not difficult to be a vegan in any way. I mean, it's not difficult at all. As a matter of fact, it's easy to be a vegan now, and so I think that it's very, very important. And I think one of the saddest and most damaging aspects of the modern organized animal movement is portraying veganism as an extreme or radical thing. It isn't. It's easy. It's something we should all be doing. And it's not something that only the heroic spirit or the self-sacrificing person can embrace. It's easy. And you feel a lot better. I mean, I don't do it for health reasons, but I have to say that, hope I don't drop dead tomorrow. But you know, at 52, I have more energy than most of my students who are young enough to be my children.
So our interview originally ended there, but we stopped the interview, put our headphones down, thought we were done with the show. But we got a phone call back, and it was from Gary. And there was one other thing he wanted to add, and it was this.
I just wanted to make one final comment to your listeners. Just as I am concerned about welfarist regulation, and I think that that's inconsistent with the abolitionist approach, I also think that violence is inconsistent with the abolitionist approach, and I think that we all ought to avoid that. When I talk about the abolitionist approach being part of a progressive social movement, what I mean in part is that we ought to see ourselves as the next step of the peace movement, and that's an example I've used for some years now, and I really think it fits. I really think that we are the next step in the peace movement, and I think that violence of any sort is inimical and inconsistent with the abolitionist idea. And just as I would urge your listeners to reject welfarist regulation, I would also urge them to reject violence.
And by violence, what do you mean? Do you mean interpersonal violence? Do you mean destruction of property?
I'm opposed to all violence. I'm opposed to all violence. But let me just say this: the idea that people think that things can be done to property without jeopardizing life—that's simply false. Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever you engage in a destructive act, there's a possibility of injuring someone, a human or a non-human. But in any event, I think it's important to reject all violence. And the one thing that it's imperative that the abolitionist idea not be associated in any way with violence. And I think to the extent that it is associated with nonviolence, because it is a movement, in my judgment, the abolitionist vegan movement is a movement of nonviolence. To the extent that it gets associated with any sort of violence, that damages the movement. We ought to stay away from that. That's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for moral, theoretical reasons. It's not good for practical reasons. It just simply doesn't make any sense. Again, I really would reinforce the idea that the abolitionist vegan movement ought to see itself as part of the peace movement, and to see that what we're objecting to is violence, and we aren't going to solve the problem of violence by more acts of violence. It's just not going to work.
I want to thank Gary once again for spending an hour with us
talking. Absolutely.
It was an incredible interview, and I think we're very lucky to finally get to talk to him.
Yeah, and I want to also thank him for all of the work that he's done, mm-hmm. Because the way in which he thinks about some of these issues has deeply influenced my own thinking on all of this.
Definitely.
And it's changed the way that I approach what I do, and I started out reading his stuff, so it changed the way I began doing what I do. And I dare say that without the kind of writing that he's done, there wouldn't be a Vegan Freak Radio or Vegan Freak anything, because it's the kind of writing that influenced me to go out and do the kinds of things that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank him again for that, for his thoughtfulness and for all the work that he does to really get us to think about animals and why we need to really abolish this notion of property status.
I agree.
So
coming up and Vegan Freak Radio in the near future, we're going to talk to Lely. Lely, who is behind Vegan Freak for a Week, and I think is a great example of creative activism.
Absolutely.
In getting so many of her friends to just, experience veganism for a week and to think about veganism for a week, and she's an amazing guide. So mm-hmm. we're going to talk to her about how that's going.
And we also have an appointment scheduled with Dr. Greger.
Yes.
Dr. Michael Greger, who has recently come out with a book from Lantern called...
Bird Flu.
Thank you. My brain is just, I am so scattered. Today's been a very long day for me. But anyway, the book is called Bird Flu, and we will be talking with him in the middle of November, so we'll have that for you shortly. In between there, I think we'll have a regular Vegan Freak Radio, not just an interview.
Yeah, we need to catch up on all our voicemails and emails and all that kind of stuff.
We do have a lot of stuff to catch up on. We're anxious to catch up on those because many of you have been writing to us with very thoughtful and incredibly good things, so we appreciate that. We always do like to hear from you. We try to respond to lots of you.
Yeah, I have not been very good at responding lately. We've been incredibly busy.
Yeah, we've been a little bogged down lately, but...
Now, coming up, we should be, in after the next week or two, we should be catching up, so...
Absolutely.
We'll
so
get back to you.
We're catching up, we're getting there, and we're trying, so...
So, we still love to hear you from you. podcast@veganfreak.com if you want to send us an email, 267-295-1944.
It should already be on your refrigerator door.
It should be.
And
or into your cell phone. I know people who have it programmed into their cell phone.
That's true. We've been at parties where people have said, "Hey, call the voicemail line 267-295-1944," or they go in their phone and get it.
So when you're drunk, you can still know the number.
That's true. That's true. I don't know. So the fucking soundboard
again. Still,
it's. I started pushing up the volume and it started fading it back down, which I didn't ask it to do.
podcast.veganfreak.com is our website for show notes.
That's right. And you can always contact us. If you're on the forums, come on over to the forums. We're there. You can fight with me about welfareism like everyone does, and I can get frustrated and just leave the thread and go, "I'm not playing anymore." Because it's a waste of my time. Anyway. I'm gone. I'm done.
Good night, everyone.
Goodbye. And don't forget, you can always find out more about Gary Francione or the Vegan Freaks on the Google.